welcome to CYC Podcast Discussions on Child and Youth Care. I'm your host, Wolfgang Vachon. Youth workers, social pedagogues, child and youth care practitioners, and allied professionals work in many places and with many different young people. For example, I've worked with many young people who do, have done, or are thinking about doing sex work. This can raise moral, legal, ethical, and relational issues. Frequently, our views on sex work are influenced by news reports of worst-case scenarios and fictional representations of sex work. This is particularly true of those who are newer to working with young people. It is rare for many to have the opportunity to have a conversation with people who do or have done sex work. Today, we're very fortunate to have such an opportunity. I'm speaking with Marcus, who also goes by the name Star, and uses pronouns such as he, him, his, and they, them, or theirs. Star is a visual artist, a writer, a student, educator, is trans, is a video maker, and passionate about social change. They've agreed to speak with me today about his time as a sex worker, which he beautifully documents in his zines, Confessions of a Teenage Transsexual Whore. Hi, Star, and thank you for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I originally reached out to you to talk about your zine, Confessions of a Teenage Transsexual Whore, and sex work. However, as I read more about your work and found out about the many, many things that you do, some of which I mentioned in the introduction, it became apparent that, as with all people who do sex work, there's so much more to you, of course, than that one aspect. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of your other aspects of yourself before we start to talk about sex work. And maybe we could start with your arts practice, because you're quite an artist as well.
Sure. Thank you. That sounds like a great place to start. For me, the series is all about art and artistic expression. And I mean, to ground it in the topic of the show, creating the series, Confessions of a Teenage Transsexual Whore, for me was a lot about getting through the experience through making art. And it, even more so, just feeling this intense drive to create and to express, to tell stories and to be inventive and to find that spark in life, even when it was very, very difficult. So, you know, from there, I've just grown as an artist, and I've been not practicing sex work for the last couple of years as I've pursued an educational degree and tried to invest more time in art making, and also been able to find another type of work to get by. And right now, I've got a website up called StarKissCreations.com, where I post my paintings, my stories, my political exploits, and all kinds of other things that go on in my life. And I'm currently working on a new anthology, which is planned to be a follow-up from the original series.
I'll make a link to StarKiss.com on the website for sure. Do you have a preference in your art? Because you are, you know, you write, you do video, you draw, you do silkscreen. Like, is it an artistic medium that you're more attracted to?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I have a bit of a renaissance queer, I guess. I have a lot of outlets, which I think is actually more common than people might realize, especially among communities of marginalized artists. You know, you're just looking for all the different ways that you can express yourself. And I know so many people who, because they don't have the money to get an agent or anything like that, they end up learning, okay, well, how do I bind a book? How do I make a cover? How do I do illustrations? How do I edit? How do I promo? How do I run an event? Like, all of a sudden you get all these skills, which for me has been like such a valuable growing experience. And I think every type of art that I make has taught me something new. The series that we're talking about today taught me a lot about editing and publishing and zine making. You know, the work that I followed since with, I came out with a film called Mosaic in 2012. More recent than that, 2014. I came out with Mosaic in 2014 with Shane Camastro, who's the co-editor of the film. And I learned so much about research, actually, which I wasn't totally expecting to be a field that I ever got interested in. but I guess it shouldn't come as a huge surprise. I am studying sociology, and I was sitting in a qualitative research class and suddenly realized I was sitting on a qualitative research project. I just had these like hours and hours and hours of what I kind of thought was road trip video. And I was like, I'll just have fun and I'll ask every person that I stay with the same list of questions. And I stayed with exclusively other trans people and went to trans meeting groups and rallies and coffee shops and music nights and just hang out with all of these trans folks and their queer friends. And I just ended up learning so much while on that journey, also a lot about myself. I mean, I was traveling by myself from Toronto to San Francisco over the course of 2 months with no job and no return ticket. And it was pretty intimidating, but I learned a lot about my own independence, a lot about gender, because what I was focusing on was asking all these people, what is gender? What is the trans community? And how do we all survive together? And I learned such deep lessons. I think one of the biggest ones being that there isn't a single trans community. There's many different people all trying to figure life out together, and some of them don't get along, some of them do, and we find these little moments of shared survival, and we try to put those together and call it something bigger than ourselves. And once I sort of saw that, I couldn't deny myself anymore the drive to get more involved in community organizing, community justice, and trying to create safer spaces for other queer and trans folks.
So would you say your community organizing, community justice comes directly out of listening to people's stories and seeing a need?
Well, I think it was both that experience of being present with those people, witnessing and holding those experiences and sharing them together, but also was very much going through those experiences myself. And sometimes it gets confusing when you have a lot of names and pronouns. experiencing poverty, experiencing sex work, sort of struggling to survive in a way that I hadn't really expected to be doing. I was born into a relatively well-off family in Winnipeg, you know, very young parents, but with enough white privilege and class power to have their own property. And I was sort of grew up with this mindset, like I would generally always have the basic necessities. And after coming out as queer and trans and losing all of that, because I chose to express my gender identity and sexuality and love for the world authentically, rather than stay inside of this like safe but confining prison, as it felt, I was really smacked in the face with the realities of capitalism, patriarchy, transphobia, ableism, I think those were the experiences. And then when I saw them reflected in other people who had their own complicated stories, that really was sort of the tipping point for me. Yeah, so I guess to answer your original question, I don't have a favorite medium because I love to paint, I love to make film. I'm a little bit better at some of them than others, but I'm always interested in any art that, to me, honors people's stories, even if it's just my own story.
You started this conversation by saying that art helped you through, while you were doing sex work, and through what you said was a difficult and dark, I think was the word you used, time. How did art support you in that time?
Yeah, I mean, art continues to support me now. And when I was first pursuing the field of doing sex work, and it was when I first moved to Toronto. I was a teenager who moved here sort of with some young love and thought that I might start a new life here and be able to live authentically. But I quickly found a lot of people find in the city, isolation, struggling finding employment, struggling holding down that employment as well, very expensive rent prices, relationships that are tainted by struggle and illness, and it became quite difficult for me to connect with other people, and especially once I started doing sex work as my main income. I was terrified of telling the truth to anybody in my life that that's what I was doing for money. Cause there was so much stigma around the work, even inside of my like so-called radical communities, people made jokes about sex workers and even if they were compassionate, it was much more in a pitying sense. And very few people thought this person right next to me could be a sex worker. And I also didn't think that about others, you know? And I after, I guess, sort of coming out as a sex worker, I realized so many people around me actually were doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. But for a long time, the 2 years that I was writing this series, I had very basically no one to talk to about it. And so that's when I started writing, seriously writing. And the way that I would process the experience is I would go to visit a client and I would do this mental sweep of the entire situation from start to finish and sort of narrate it in my mind and try to keep track of things like, what did it smell like? What did it taste like? What were the sights and the sounds? What was the weather like? You know, what was my mood? All of these little pieces coming together. And I started really looking for the beauty in those moments and in the beauty in struggling and in suffering. And also, you know, these beautiful little interactions that would sometimes happen that were funny or sweet or touching or sad. And then coming home with all of that and sort of bringing it together and transforming it into a narrative or a story. And then I would take that story and actually post it to this anonymous blog. That was my first semblance of an accepting community, where the people who started following that blog and sending me messages just saying, you know, thank you for writing, thank you for sharing this. And I think one of the reasons it really struck a chord is because there was so few trans masculine people who were writing about doing sex work and non-binary people. Coming from that perspective as well, I think a lot of people were excited to see that work. And for me, that's really what kept me going a lot, was this idea that I'm not alone in this, even if it's just these anonymous faces on the internet, or even if it's just me in a Word document. I think that broke down a lot of the isolation.
Mm. Reading the zine and the stories, they can be very uncomfortable to read, right? Mm. And they can be quite graphic, because sex is very graphic.
Yeah.
And it raises, you know, lots of discomfort. And and I find myself, as I read it, you know, wanting to rescue or help or save, and all these, you know, youth worky, child and youth care, you know, patriarchal, matriarchal tendencies coming out. And as someone who works with young people, you know, it's a struggle for me to think about the young people I work with having those experiences and dealing with those experiences. You felt isolated. How could people support you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a great question, for lots of different reasons. And yeah, I definitely wrote the zines to be uncomfortable, because I was feeling uncomfortable, and I wrote them for myself. And then I sort of let people read them. And then if they want to put themselves through it, they do. And I think that people learn a lot from the experience. And I think it can be... I hope that when people are doing that reading, they kind of put themselves in those shoes and imagine their life having a set of circumstances that led them to that type of moment, and imagining what they might do in any of those situations, and hopefully finding some empathy for the choices that many people who do sex work, either because they choose to or because they have to, or usually a mix of both, as is pretty common inside of capitalism. I hope that they find that empathy. And yeah, and I also think that empathy can lead people to wanting to, you know, step in and be this sort of savior character. But the reality is that the protagonist, myself, there isn't a savior who just steps in and solves the problem. And I think that's an important reality to recognize, that even if let's imagine that protagonist had some sort of like magical person step into their life and provide safe shelter and secure food and some sort of like income that was safer, that wouldn't solve the problem of sex work. That wouldn't solve the problem of poverty, of housing insecurity and homelessness, of LGBTQ people experiencing rejection from their families of origin. And I think it's important to recognize these issues instead of as an individual that you're going to just like work with one-on-one and save, but instead sort of step back and see that systemic perspective, which I think I am trying to bring out throughout the series. Is this is a story of you know, post-modernity. This is a story of struggling through the systems of oppression that exist, of struggling to find a safe place to sleep or a safe place to eat, and making the choices you have to make to get through it. And I think what's really interesting through a lot of the narrative is coming to these moments where basically there's no, like, you don't really have a lot of options. You know, you can either, like, you know, I'm thinking for one example, I don't even know if I included this story in the zine because it is very graphic, but I think that it is in there, where I'm meeting with this client, they've already given me the money, and they're asking me at the very last minute, we're already, like, in bed together, they don't want to wear a condom, and I think that they've only given me, like, half up front or whatever, something like that. There's this situation where I know that, and they're also, like, much stronger than I am, much bigger than I am, I'm in their house, I, like, you know, they have all of the control. And I'm faced with this choice, do I say no and put myself in a potentially dangerous situation, or do I say yes and have unprotected sex with a stranger who clearly is not a very trustworthy person? And I think those kind of moments make the reader very uncomfortable because, you know, that's such a painful experience for anybody to go through. But it is a real experience that people are going through every day. And I think it's important to sit with that discomfort and to recognize and just sort of feel that pain instead of trying to fix it.
And so as, you know, someone who works with children and youth, what I'm hearing is support the individual and work towards addressing the larger inequalities that lead to, you know, as you say, combination of choice and no choice with sex work.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I think that's one of the reasons I've become so political. I mean, I've always had a mind for politics, but definitely getting to recognize that, like, systemic oppression is a lot of the times the cause of the violence and the suffering, and we need to address that problem while also supporting these individuals. And then also just to, you know, to speak to something that you said earlier about, well, what you got me thinking about was the child and youth care workers who were in my life at that time. I was in the series, I talk about attending this support group for youth under 29 who identify as trans. And even though that community itself wasn't always the safest for me, there's this really special relationship I had with the coordinator that I talk about in one of the stories a little later in the series. And I have just been, you know, sexually assaulted while on the job. And I'm really, really struggling to just make it through the day and process the experience. And the coordinator of the group center senses something's wrong, and I hang around and I help with dishes and clean up. And they just take that, you know, extra, you know, well, I think they took like an extra hour out of their day, and they ride the subway home with me, take me out for a milkshake, and I end up sort of talking about what's happened and just about like how I'm struggling. And they didn't do anything to really drastically change my life, but they sat there and they listened, and, you know, they wanted me to know I wasn't alone, and they gave me a couple tokens so that I could come to the group next week, and they paid for my dinner. And I think those acts of kindness and compassion sometimes get lost for people who've been in the field for too long. You know, I certainly understand burnout, and I struggle with it myself. I'm doing support work for students. That is my current job. But it's so, so important just to have those moments where people feel listened and, like, honestly heard and respected. And sometimes there's not always a fix. Sometimes you just need to listen.
You know, you're also talking about that going beyond what's expected, right? Going beyond the, you know, it's 5 o'clock or 7 or 9 o'clock or whatever it is, and I'm done, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's what we hear time and time again, right? That the workers that make that difference are the ones who say, hey, let's go for a milkshake. Mm-hmm. What's going on, and not try to fix it mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a high price to ask for a lot of people too, because everybody's dealing with their own crap. So, you know, I recognize not everybody can be there, but like that individual definitely changed my life. And, in that moment and so many other little interactions, I think those are the reasons why I'm still here today.
When we talk about sex work, particularly from the perspective of child and youth care practitioners or social service practitioners, there's the moral issues that come up. there's also legal issues that come up. And I remember listening to a panel that had a profound effect on me. And I've reflected on this panel many, many times. And it was a panel about underage sex work, right? So sex workers who are under the legal age of, of 18. And they use this term about the rescue industry. And the rescue industry being the social service agencies and industry that are going to come and take me away. And they're going to, remove me from harm's way. And the take on it, which was so disquieting for me, was if I'm with a client, that person only has my body for an hour. You want to remove me for years. And it became, once again, a very difficult moment for me, because the idea of saying, oh, you're 15 or 16 or whatever, you're doing sex work, okay, I'll let you, goes against so much of what's going on, why I want to be working with young people. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really tough one. And I also just want to preface, like, I can't speak for all sex workers or all people who've experienced sex work, and I certainly don't try to. I would say largely, even though I've had a lot of pain and struggle in my experience, I also have moved with a lot of privilege as a masculine person, as a white person, as a person who came back from a background that, English is my first language, and my parents both graduated from university. And I think every situation is very different. And just to recognize that a lot of people are just doing what they literally have to do to survive. And I think what I always ask people in those kind of hypotheticals is to imagine that exact same situation, except for the work that the person is doing is that they're working 12 hours overnight at Tim Hortons or McDonald's, or, they're doing some other kind of soul-sucking labor where they are selling still selling their body, just in a different configuration. Maybe they're selling their body as it flips hamburgers. But I think that sexualized work, it often sort of has this adult connotation for valid reasons. But I think it's also very important to recognize it as work, as labor that's existing inside of this bigger system that is oppressive to all of us. And so in those moments where people are practicing sex work in unsafe situations in one way or another, whether or not they're like under the age of consent to do that work, or they're engaging with clients who are not very safe themselves, which your setup doesn't even necessarily say, but let's sort of imagine that. I think when I'm faced with those situations, I try to step back and just sort of ground myself and remember, like, this is work. How do I support people who are working crappy jobs? And again, sort of look at, okay, why is this person doing work in this way? What would it look like if sex work was decriminalized or legalized? What would it look like if this person had more security in other areas of their life? And I guess generally just sort of pursue a harm reduction approach rather than that total just cut them off from, which is something that is likely a person's income, and also potentially could be a sense of identity, access to community, independence, agency. If somebody had tried to rescue me from doing sex work, I would have not appreciated it at all. And, even years later, I was speaking to a family member who didn't know I had been doing the work and who said, well, you should have just called me and asked for me for money. And I'm like, no, because then I would have been in your debt and you would have been holding that debt over me for years. Instead, I got my money my way and I survived when you rejected me. So I think that it's important to sort of, just really look at the big picture, because it's so easy to get caught up in that moral and emotional space, which is totally understandable, but not necessarily actually helpful for the person who is going through that experience.
What might a harm reduction approach look like? Any thoughts?
Harm reduction approach to sex work?
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that comes to my mind, well, it's hard because I always ask a lot of people, probably more than people can give, but I would say the first thing that I think of is finding sustainable housing and accessible housing, affordable housing, because to me, I think that was such a core aspect. It was always when the rent was due, and I knew it was either go see a client or get kicked out, and I always was paying my rent late anyways. And, you know, I wasn't even making enough from one client. So then it would be, okay, how many clients, and doing the math, how many clients do I have to see to pay the rent? And then how many more do I have to see to make sure I have food in my belly? And if I can get food from the food bank, how many do I have to see to make sure I can pay the rent and get cigarettes? You know, there's always, you know, life things. So yeah, I think about affordable housing and I think about access to food, like real access to food, not show up at the food bank a month early with all of your receipts from the past year, type of thing, but like actually like meals that are available to community, meals where people can come and cook and access the food directly, like all that kind of stuff. And like direct empowerment, I guess to bring it back down a little bit, is just focusing on the direct empowerment, I think is the crux for, in my experience. You know, being trusted with jobs and roles inside of the organizations and communities we're a part of. You know, I remember treasuring the opportunities where at this youth group I was attending, I would be asked to go, I would be given, you know, $40 and asked to go to the store and get food. And there's this relationship of trust there, which, you know, takes time to build and is not always realistic with every youth. But like finding a person's talents and skills and allowing opportunities for them to really shine at what they're actually good at. You know, maybe sex work is something that they're good at. And also there's probably lots of other things, like, you know, the way we open this interview, people who do sex work are complicated and have a lot going on, just like most people. And so I really focus, I think of that as the harm reduction approach is, if a person is doing sex work, survival sex work, and they're a youth, you know, it can be a very traumatic experience as well as a very empowering experience. But I think the best way to support anybody who's going through that is to say to them, okay, what are you passionate about? What are you good at? Or maybe what are you just like sort of interested in? Or what role are you looking to serve inside of your community? And I mean, I'm talking like it's always easy to get youth to open up about that stuff, and it's not. And, you know, there's not going to be easy answers. But those are the things that come to my mind first and foremost.
Nice. As we move towards ending this conversation today, you've made a bit of a journey from, you know, you openly, you know, talk about your own upbringing and, you know, some privilege that existed within that. And you've gone through a journey of, you know, service user, of someone who's accessed services to a place now where you provide services. And I've met a variety of people over the years, and I've always been quite fascinated with that journey from service user to service provider. And for people who are doing that, because many, many people come into this work with their own lived experiences, any insights on how to make that transition for oneself or for yourself?
That's a tough one because it's not always accessible. I think that I have had, like we both have said, you know, a lot of privilege and a lot of luck. Like I showed up the first day of university, wandered into the LGBT center, and there was a job wanted posting, and I applied, and because I was trans and nobody else was applying who was trans, there was kind of this like, oh crap, we should probably hire that person and get some trans program going on. And that's what we've done, and we've created the Trans Collective, which is great. But you know, as you can see, anybody else who you know, wandered to a different part of the campus or who applied to the job but didn't put it on their resume that they were trans or hadn't had volunteer experience, like there's so many different barriers that people have to accessing, you know, employment inside of the service providing world or even education in the service provider world. I mean, I'm not even in a service provider program. I'm in sociology. And I just happen to be good at doing this work. And, but you know, I think the system itself is quite inaccessible. So I guess my advice is sort of difficult because it kind of depends on your circumstance. If you can access education, if you can access employment in the area, or even if you can just access volunteering in the area, like my first window into that world was volunteering for a helpline. And I think that was just such an incredible experience. It taught me so much about being able to provide interpersonal support, on counseling, on community. The, you know, hotline itself was really close, like a family. They always provided food, and it was a youth program as well. So there was always a fridge full of food, and so if I showed up for my shift, I could eat my dinner as well. So I think setting up those kind of situations is really, really great. If you're already in power, is to sort of imagine your service users not as just service users, but as people who are potentially rising through the ranks into becoming providers. Because I think it's when you access those communities, you learn those skills. And so for people who are on that journey themselves, like I've been, yeah, my advice would be to, like, listen to your heart, follow your passion. You are good at, like, lots of amazing things, and you do have an important and powerful role to play in your community, whether it's being a storyteller, being a problem solver, being an event planner, being the one who goes and buys the groceries, like, doing the dishes, you know? These are all essential community roles, and once you find your place or your places or where you like to float around, and it gets a lot easier to actually imagine yourself staying there and growing there and then eventually becoming, you know, a leader in that area.
That's very, very well said. I really like the idea of recognizing that people who come into the field are going to have that, and how do we support and nurture and foster that. Anything else that you want to talk about today, Star, before we wrap up?
Well, and, you know, I want to give a shout out to all my other sex workers out there, artists out there, queer and trans folks out there, just to say that I love you and you're great and you deserve everything in the whole world. And to everybody who's listening to this and all of our allies out there, just, you know, I have to believe in my heart 100%. If we do continue to try to nurture communities that are focused around love and justice, we can transform the world around us. And that's what I'm trying to do in my own little part of the world, making my art.
And I really appreciate your willingness to come and share that with me and with the listeners today. And I think you are doing that. I think you are transforming. And I encourage everybody to check out Star at starkiss.com.
Starkisscreations.com.
Thank you very much. Starkisscreations.com. And if you missed that, it'll be on the podcast website. Thank you very much, Star.
Yeah, thanks so much.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.